snap, child, and don't cry. Your folks might understand you by and by. Just move on up toward your destination, though you may find from time to time complication.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome, welcome, welcome to French Connections Wednesday edition. Today's date is the 9th of January, 2008. My name is Daryl Bradford Smith. Great to have you here for another installment of the French Connections most important of broadcasts. It's been a few days since we've had a broadcast. Things have happened over here to my computer. I got a virus that fried my computer's audio system and cooked up some stuff and had some problems with a new, trying to put an operating system in because of the problems with the original virus, and now it's pretty much dead. Looking like I need another computer, and I don't have the money for it, but we're going to find out a way. Maybe I got a guy that fixes computers down the way here, and I think he's got some old refurbished ones that I can maybe pick up for a decent price. I don't need a screen and all that, so we're taking a look at it. But anyway, I have no audio on my computer, and I'm not even able to hear my own audio files, and I'm not able to manipulate any of the stuff I do, so it's kind of a pain in the neck. So I apologize for that. You know, we're low tech over here. and we just make do with the pieces we have, and sometimes one breaks, we try to jury-rig another one a little bit and get that going. But anyway, things are happening. I guess, you know, one of the things I wanted to bring up before we start in on the discussion we have with my guest is this New Hampshire primary. It looks like the two favorite criminals are getting their promotion. The McCain-Clinton duo, if you will accept that description. They are, Hillary Clinton is probably the most murderous politico ever in the history of American politics. I mean, what, 150 or 60 murders to their credit, the Clintons? I don't know how many Mr. George Bush, W. Bush has, but I think Bill and Hillary actually were like the murder champions or something. I mean, like 12 or 15 policemen that guarded them during their professional career were murdered, and you know, people who saw them do anything got snuffed. They had a snuff team out for everybody. But anyway, and now we got this guy John McCain, who I've told you his family was given large sums of money from the Brothman fortune to have an exclusive contract with the drinks distribution in California, Arizona, and New Mexico, and parts of Colorado, I believe, in Utah, and Nevada even. And I think it's a $100 million company that they were helped build through the Zionist criminal network. So if you don't think he's beholden to criminal Zionism, then you're crazy. Not to mention his father's dealings with the USS Liberty and him being hated by every veteran in the country who has a brain. But that being said, that's for another show. Today, we're going to talk with somebody who's been on many times. He's a friend. He's a researcher and somebody that I've come to trust on his take on historical events. And his name is Andrew Carrington Hitchcock. We put the Carrington in to make sure you get him when you Google him. He wrote, of course, the book called The Synagogue of Satan that has been used in many other referrals to the criminal Zionist group that we all are battling against. So if you Google the Synagogue of Satan, you may find his book and other information. But it is with my great pleasure that I bring him back to the French Connection to do another installment of his book. Andrew, are you with me?
Yes, I am, Daryl. Thank you for inviting me back onto your show.
It's great to have you back. And, how's this connection for you, Andrew? Can you hear well?
Yeah, I can hear you loud and clear.
Wonderful, good. Well, last time we worked up to 1991, and of course, to refresh people's memories, we're working backwards from the present to the past. And the present 30-page discussion is going to start in 1974 and work our way back up to 91. So we're going to deal a bit with the end of the Nixon era and into the era of Mr. Peanut, President Peanut from Georgia, and then, of course, into the Daddy Bush and the Reagan years. But we're going to start out here with the Watergate scandal, and you'll find that if you're following along with the book you've bought from Andrew on page 180. But it talks a bit here about the resignation of Nixon, and I happen to know from my own learning that Nixon was being hounded out of office for several reasons, but the Zionist criminals in control of the government had become fed up with his leadership for a couple of reasons, and even on his tapes in the Oval Office, he's heard complaining about these people and the way they're doing him, and it looks like they were the people who outed him. And if it's interesting to note that a Bernstein was involved in getting the information out. But do you have anything to add to his information there?
Well, Daryl, I mean, we have to remember as well, and not a lot of people are aware of this, and we'll focus on that on the next installment, but Spiro Agnew, when he went, he made an interesting speech about Jewish power just before he went. With Nixon, always talking about the Watergate scandal, but we're not told that in 1971, Nixon had instructed some officials to investigate the activity of Jewish IRS agents who he had intelligence were actually protecting wealthy Jews in America from paying the tax that they should have done. And, of course, shortly after that, we have this Watergate scandal.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know that this guy... He was a bit of a ends justify the means kind of leader, but all of them have been from the beginning. I'm wondering, was he playing ball with them early on? And it seems to me early in his career, he wasn't in a position not to play ball with them. But as president, he started doing a few things that they weren't very happy with. Is that true?
Well, yes, I think that's what happens in a lot of cases. I mean, you have to play ball with them to get power, and a lot of these people suddenly think that once they've got the power, they're the president and they're in charge. And, of course, Kennedy made that mistake along with many other presidents before him, like, Abraham Lincoln and what have you. The other thing with Nixon, he definitely was part of this elite. For the interests of the listeners, if they just go into Google or whatever search engine they want to use, Yahoo or whatever, and they just type in Reagan, Nixon, Bohemian Grove photo, and there's a very famous photo of Reagan and Nixon sat at the same table in Bohemian Grove back in the late 50s, early 60s, I believe.
Yeah, he actually states in one of his Oval Office tapes that he didn't like going there because it was full of, as he referred to them, as a bunch of faggots, is what he said. And that's very clearly heard on the Nixon tapes, in fact. But the other truth is that he was allowed, he allowed the power of the presidency to be handed over to Kissinger, who has continued in an unbroken line of power to today, in fact, Henry Kissinger. And so the shadow controller behind the scenes has always been either Brzezinski, Kissinger, or even some of these other guys like Scowcroft, but Kissinger is one of the main players, is he not?
Yes, the interesting thing about Kissinger is that I initially started off putting together all the Bilderberg Group information until I realized that there was a group behind them far stronger than that. It's just peeling back the layers of the onion, isn't it, really, as you know. But what you find with Kissinger is I think that certainly up until 2005, I believe, or 2006, he'd been to literally every Bilderberg meeting, and he's the only person to have attended every one. Rockefeller went to every one, but he missed one, I believe. But Kissinger had been to every one up to that point. So, you know, that just goes to show that he's the only one at every one. So it goes to show how long he has had that power.
He's the continuity between presidents. It doesn't matter if a Democrat arrives or a Republican arrives. Kissinger is always in the shadows, with decision making power and edicts being meted down by him to the leadership. Is that correct?
Well, that's certainly the way it would appear. I mean, if we use the evidence that we have, it's very difficult to draw any other conclusion.
Yeah. And of course, when you take a look at the railroading, because in some ways, Nixon's departure was, in effect, a destruction of his ability to get any traction on anything that the Jews in control, the Zionist Jews in control, wouldn't want to have had to happen. And you talk here on the 10th of December, the United States National Security Council under Kissinger classified 200 pages of the study memorandum 200. You want to talk a little bit about that population growth?
Yeah, that's very interesting, because what they're trying to say here is that it's a threat to U.S. security for the third world countries, if you like, to their the way that they're reproducing, and they're reproducing too fast, and they need to reduce population growth in those countries, and they look at birth control, war and famine as means of doing that. And of course, again, the reason that the facts that I put together have an effect now is because we can read something like that and see exactly what's gone on since with AIDS and the different wars and civil wars, and so they tell us here what they're going to do, and then if we wind forward a few years, then we can see that they've done it. So,
well, yes, and Andrew, there's actual minutes to congressional hearings talking about the funding of research into an AIDS type of virus, and they discuss it in rather non-specific terminology because they didn't want the general public to have record of it. But they do discuss starting a program that looks into ways of having viral specific population specific viruses, and lo and behold, not very long after the advent of AIDS actually came into the 80s, but this came in the early 70s under Nixon and Kissinger, did it not?
Yes, it did. I mean, the discussions were there then. Of course, we'd had the real moving forward of science, really, throughout the 60s and into the 70s and what have you. And this is where I think that it really starts to kick off and starts to move forward, all in preparation for the 80s when it all, when they obviously knew what they had then, and then they test it here and there until they unleash it in the late 70s, early 80s.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's discuss then the Harold Rosenthal character, because people actually, I've had this guy, what was his name, Matthias, tell people that this guy Rosenthal was a fraud, and he really didn't say the things he said and didn't report the things. I think it was this guy, Andrew Matthias. But the fact is, Jacob Javits, a very prominent Zionist Jew, had this assistant named Harold Rosenthal. And in fact, he did say a lot of things that were documented. And one of them you wrote right here. You want to give the quote?
Yeah, one thing he said in his book, because I think that you've got that up on your site, haven't you, the Harold Rosenthal?
Yeah.
I forget what it's called now, but I think it's up there. It says what he says in there is, most Jews do not like to admit it, but our God is Lucifer. Again, it's an interesting book that he's written. There is a lot of speculation as to, oh, is this true, is this not true? A bit like sort of people were talking about the protocols, even though it's referred to as a forgery, which is a copy of the original. But here, again, it's a quote that I put in there because the work's out there. It's been attributed to him. And interestingly, I think that not long after that, he died mysteriously, didn't he?
Well, and of course, what in 77 we begin to see the full weight of racism in Israel begin to take its toll here. On Christmas Day, the Knesset passes the anti-missionary law that says anyone of non-Jewish Christians is apprehended giving the New Testament to an Israeli can face a jail term up to 5 years. Is that off the hook or what? I mean, if you're proselytizing anybody in Israel, and you're a Christian, non-Jewish Christian, you get up to 5 years in jail.
Well, yes, it just goes to show, and I always try and highlight the differences here, that these are the sort of laws that Israel will pass, the Zionists over there, they'll be in charge of the media and the political systems in other countries, and they'll promote all this diversity and acceptance of other faiths and creeds, cultures, races, etc. But in their country, they're the most inherently racist and single-minded out of any country in the world, and yet they get other countries to live in a diverse way, while at the same time it's all pro-Zionist in their country.
Well, and I refer people back to the Bishop of Jerusalem, having done three programs with us, discusses clearly that most of the victims that he had been dealing with over his career of 20-plus years were Christians themselves, Christian Palestinians who were victimized by the Israeli Zionist criminals. And in fact, most Americans believe that the Palestinians are by and large only Muslim. And in fact, the Palestinians are from many different sects. The fact that they're Palestinians means that they're Semitic people from the area called Palestine, but not necessarily Muslims or Christians or other, in fact.
Yes, I agree. And again, it just that point you just raised there about Americans believing Palestinians are all Muslims, it was the same thing with the Lebanon conflict back in September 2006, when it was all portrayed in the media that the Lebanese were a bunch of radical extremist Al-Qaeda Muslim types, when actually a large proportion of the people they were attacking were Christian Lebanese, and they were actually in the Christian areas, in the particular Christian areas that they were attacking.
Well, you'll notice in 78 we're fully into Jimmy Carter's term, and of course Carter, it seemed like he was of a mind or thinking that he could make a difference when it came to the Jewish control of the country, and actually stated publicly that if the occupation, the illegal occupation continues, he says he's going to consider cutting off aid to Israel. Now, most people my age will remember the demonization and vilification of Carter began around the same time as this statement he made, and the press started characterizing him as a buffoon and an imbecile. And, of course, you know, he never got reelected because what they had successfully done was cast him in a different light in the eyes of the American public, and in a position that he never recovered from. And of course this happened in 1978, but you'll see the evidence of it in the way that the press treated his sex successes and failures. And then if you take a pro-Israeli president like George W., nothing this man does gets demonized or vilified, because he's on board with them. But if you're not on board with them in every sense of the word, all of a sudden, you know, you get hammered left, right, and center, and of course, that was the end of Carter, was it not?
Oh, it was, and with Carter, and the other interesting thing with the Carter presidency is, of course, you had those hostages being held by Khomeini in Iran. Mm-hmm. And it was actually, they were ready to be released while Carter was still in power, but they didn't want it to happen until Reagan and Bush got in. And so then it would look like, hey, they got them out, when it had all been arranged beforehand. And so these people were left there to rot for a few more months, as it were, simply so they can try and get political capital out of that.
Well, you know, we can see evidence further as the next administration came in, of course. We see somebody, and this is a hero of mine, as for at least in his actions throughout his career, Marlon Brando. Mm. I'd like everybody to know the bravery that Marlon Brando displayed in returning an Oscar, saying that he would not accept an Oscar to stop the American government, criminal government, from killing Indians on the reservation of Wounded Knee. But he also, the Sioux Indians, but he also said something quite important about the control of Hollywood. You want to give that quote there for everybody so they can understand just how in touch with the facts Marlon Brando was?
Yes, well, Dale, this is in 1979 in the January issue of Playboy magazine. He stated in an interview regarding Jewish control over Hollywood, his quote was, "You've seen every single race besmirched, but you never saw an unfavorable image of the kike, because the Jews were ever so watchful for that. They never allowed it to be shown on screen." Yep. The interesting thing here is that, again, look at the evidence. When have you seen actions of Jews attacked in Hollywood films? It just simply doesn't happen. And so, again, I say to people, if you're offended by his use of the terminology that he used, that was what he chose to use in that interview, that's what he has said. But what I want to get across to people is, give us the films, you know, where and prove Marlon Brando wrong. He isn't wrong, and he wasn't wrong in 79, and he's not wrong in 2008, because the films aren't there. They're always done with a pro-Jewish slant, and they'll attack other races any way, which way they can. Anything to further their own agenda, but they will never turn on themselves. And they promote, and they say it's artistic freedom, integrity. That's absolute poppycock. You will never get funding for a Hollywood film that's going to in any way question the actions of these people.
Well, they try to marginalize his ability to get work. And in fact, his performances in subsequent years after The Godfather, which was in the mid-70s, were really terrible because he was getting very bad offers. Nothing good was coming into Marlon Brando. And I watched a program about him that was rather balanced. And he decided to kind of check out because he knew that as long as he stayed in the Hollywood area, he was going to be victimized by these forces. But ultimately, his family was victimized, his daughter, and he was embroiled in a terrible situation. But people should look into what Marlon Brando had to say. And this is one of the reasons why, that almost no major star today is a non-Jew. You have to take a look at all the stars today. They all have connections to Judaism, every one of them. And the fact of the matter is they bank on the fact that if they promote a Jew into a role of star in Hollywood, they won't have someone come back and bite them in the rear end later in an attack such as Marlon Brando launched on them. And you'll notice that the people who are non-Jewish are always kind of kooky or easily marginalized as far as Hollywood is concerned. But take a look at – I mean, there is almost no great star in Hollywood who is not Jewish. It's just – you know, it's a sad fact. And it goes way back. Take a look at some of the people, you know, Tony Curtis and Kurt Douglas, and go back in time, and you can find almost to a man throughout history, every major star is Jewish, and even into today.
Well, yes, Darrell, and you know, one thing that I would bring up now, I know we're jumping forward a bit, but it's pretty much world famous, the film Borat.
Yes.
Is that Sacha Baron Cohen who, you know, essentially goes into different situations as an actual person from Kazakhstan, although obviously he's a Jewish actor. And one of the famous bits in the film is he goes to some nightclub-type place to play a song saying he's from Kazakhstan, and the song is Throw the Jew Down the Well. And I think the idea behind that as well is simply because that's in a humorous song where he says, I think it's in my country we have problems and the problem is the Jew. And it's all satirized in the film that this guy's obviously mad because he's blaming the problems of a country on Jews. Of course, that now being in a comedy film that's been promoted as quite cool and cleverly done and different things like that, you know, if anybody sort of looks at these things and sees Zionist control, that's another little lever that they've put in place to say, oh, look, you're just like those rednecks in the crowd, or do you see what I mean? And this is another aspect that they do it now.
Yep. Well, they're very sophisticated in the way they promote anti-Semitism to make it seem as though anybody who speaks out against them is either a racist redneck or a crazy. And you'll notice that even in shows like Star Trek and others, they characterize people as anybody who wants a gun is a lunatic or a fringe militia. Anybody, and you'll notice that there's a thread running through most of these Hollywood productions that advances their agenda. Let's go on here to the Georgia Guidestones because interesting these things. They say they're Freemasonry, but you and I both know the roots of modern Freemasonry are in the hands of Zionist Judaism, and they have their strength. They draw their strength in that organization from Kabbalistic teachings, do they not?
Well, exactly, Darrell, and I would say Bilderberg Group, Bohemian Grove, Council on Foreign Relations, Royal Institute of International Affairs, Freemasonry, it's all now in control of this Zionist group, and it all leads off that same group. And as we discussed in the past, and before I put this book together, I was looking at doing a little bit on the Bilderberg Group, a little bit on the CFR and different things, thinking that they were different areas that interlocked, but suddenly you could see the mechanism behind what was pulling them together. And that's the instructive mechanism, which could always be traced back to Zionist Jews, whichever way you want to look at it. It's just up to the listener how far they want to peel back the onion. If they want to just look at the Bilderberg Group, then they'll end with that. But then you go further, and you get further and further. And it always leads back to a Zionist Jew, which is why I did the research that I did, and that was as far as I could take it, and I couldn't go beyond that.
Well, you know, they're still trying to characterize these facts and the books that are being put out as racist tripe. And in fact, the statistics bear it out. And one of the things that you write here about the immigration from the Soviet Union as it imploded and became Russia again, one of the byproducts of this mess was the wholesale theft of their natural resources. At the same time, much of the elite guard of the Soviet infrastructure, the bureaucrats at high level, and they happened to mostly be of the Jewish persuasion, emigrated from Russia into to the West as well as to Israel. And you'll also notice at that time that the Russian mob was heavily influenced by these same forces as they are today. And so you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, just to put it into context now, we're talking about from 1970 to 1980, and these are official emigration figures, so people leaving Russia from the Soviet government running from 1970 to 1980. 246,000 Jews have been allowed to emigrate from Russia, and that compares with, in the same time period, only 2,000 non-Jews. So that's 246,000 Jews, and only 2,000 non-Jews are allowed to leave in that 10-year period. But to make the figures even more unbelievable is that there were only 3 million Jews living in Russia at the time, compared with 255 million non-Jews. And so we're talking about an infinitesimal percentage of 1%.
Yeah.
Of non-Jews compared with Jews. And if that doesn't show racial bias, I don't know what does. And 157,000 of those Jews, of the 246,000 in that 10-year period, ended up in Israel. And, of course, further down the line, we'll speak later about the fall of the Soviet Union, and that's when you had a massive push of Jews from the Soviet Union to Israel. But they're very clearly trying to bolster up that country at that point. They started with this and moved it forward.
Well, we can move. I mean, you have to know also that as they were leaving, they took with them everything that wasn't nailed down of value. And of late, and I still haven't got a clear feel for what Putin has done over there, whether he is a pro or anti-Zionist, because in one clip on television he'll be doing a deal with them, and in the next clip he's decrying and deriding them for their killing of his nation. And so he plays both sides of the fence, and I can never get a real clear take on him. But the fact is, in other countries of this era, and in the 80s, they were really, some of them were going through terrible financial problems. And of course, the United States had what they called a recession in the early 80s. But the world at large was having it. And there, you gave an example in here about how the Zionist-controlled IMF really put the screws to Ecuador. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Yes. It's very interesting because Ecuador's government wanted a loan of $1.5 billion in 83 from the IMF that the listeners will be well aware is Rothschild-controlled. The interesting thing were, was the government were forced to take over the unpaid private debts of Ecuador's elite. And these are unpaid private debts Ecuador's elite owed to the private banks in Ecuador.
The elites happened to be Jewish.
Yeah, just for a change. But exactly. And so what they're saying is, right, you want IMF money, then part of the agreement is you've got to pay off the debts of, not of poor people, of the elite. And so they come and rescue the Jews in Ecuador. The IMF then dictate price hikes in electricity and other utilities. And that didn't give them enough money to pay the interest. So they then ordered Ecuador to sack 120,000 workers. Subsequently, they needed to do a variety of things on a timetable that the IMF imposed. That included raising the price of cooking gas by 80% by the year 2000. This is an interesting one, Daryl, that you and I focus on a lot. Transferring the ownership of its water system to foreign operators, something that's happened in America, France, England, most countries around the world now, because they love getting control of water. Granting British Petroleum the rights to build and own an oil pipeline over the Andes, and eliminating the jobs of further workers whilst reducing the wages of those remaining by 50%.
And you know, here's the interesting thing, because during this period, they always kept the flame of terrorism alive in the world. And behind most of these acts of terrorism, all through the 70s, whether it be Munich in the early 70s, 72, to whether it be the Achille Lauro with the Klinghoffer, Abu Didal was an Israeli agent, the Israelis were constantly stirring the pot of terrorism in order to keep a fear factor in the world and keep that as an element of their ability to negotiate with other governments. And you'll notice that the Mossad was actually really flexing its muscles at this point. But one of their own left their side, if you believe his story. Some do, some don't, and I'm not here to verify whether he is for real or not, but his name was Viktor Arshevsky. And you want to say a little bit about what Viktor had to say about his own organization, the Mossad?
Well, yes. I mean, there's a couple of bits that come up here with Viktor Arshevsky through the years that we go through. But here, if we focus on the October 23rd, 1983 bomb blast in the United States Marine Barracks in Beirut, which resulted in the deaths of 241 U.S. servicemen. Viktor Ostrovsky says in his book, By Way of Deception, that Israel did have advanced knowledge of the attack, but did not bother to warn the Americans. He said, and this is what he states in his book, and I quote, "The general attitude at Mossad about the Americans was, as far as the Yanks go, we are not here to protect them." And now, when you bear in mind that only 2 or 3 years earlier, there'd been a deal arranged where America would give $3 billion in aid to Israel every year, and they can't even be bothered to warn them about an attack on their own people. But then you have to ask, why would they not want to? And who actually was behind the attacks? Because, again, who benefits out of it? Well, Israel benefits, because then they can demonize Beirut again.